Part 2. In this part, you will hear 3 short talks. After each talk, you will hear 6 questions about it. Before each talk begins, you will have time to preview the questions. You will hear each talk and the questions once. You can take notes if you wish. Choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D. Now you will hear the first talk. Look at the questions. Listen to a tour guide talking to tourists.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Anna. On behalf of Big Apple Tours, I'd like to welcome you to New York. You will be checking in your hotel in 10 minutes, so I have just enough time to brief you on the must-see places in New York. First is Manhattan's Chinatown, ringed by Tribeca, the former Little Italy, the Lower East Side, and Civic Center. It has the highest concentration of Chinese people in the Western Hemisphere. Yet, it is no longer the largest Chinese enclave in New York, as that honor has gone to Flushing Chinatown in Queens. Together with Little Italy, Chinatown is New York's top foodie neighborhood, and the fishmongers and greengrocers around Canal Street, East Broadway, Mott Street, and Mulberry Street are perpetually eye-opening. Nearby Little Italy will amaze you with its narrow streets, red, white, and green garland, and vintage Italianish storefronts. Unfortunately, its future is under threat by rising rents that force long-standing businesses to close, a dwindling Italian population, and receding boundaries because of a constant creep from nearby Soho and Chinatown. You definitely don't want to miss Rockefeller Center. The proportions of this vertical complex in Midtown are astonishing, especially when you remember that it was built throughout the Great Depression. It's made up of 19 commercial buildings broken by a sunken central plaza, all commissioned by the Rockefeller family, who first made their money in the oil industry. There's much at street level at the Rockefeller Center, a building immortalized in countless movies, like the much-loved skating ring and Christmas tree. So, that more or less sums it up for the day. Thank you for your attention, everyone, and on behalf of Big Apple Tours, we wish you a pleasant and memorable stay.
Number 21. When and where is the tour guide probably talking to the tourists? Number 22. What is true of Chinatown? Number 23. What is the characteristic of Little Italy? Number 24. What is the problem facing Little Italy? Number 25. What is amazing about the Rockefeller Center? Number 26. What is implied about the Rockefeller Center? Now you will hear the second talk. Look at the questions. Listen to a host on a radio show.
Good morning. You are listening to Jack Alvin's afternoon show on Star Radio. It's Saturday, the 3rd of July. Today, rather than give you marketing advice, I'm going to tell you the story of John Paul DeJoria, the $3.1 billion worth co-founder of John Paul Mitchell Systems hair products and philanthropist. Born into a poor immigrant household, DeJoria held a series of jobs including janitor, door-to-door encyclopedia salesman, and insurance salesman, and at age 23, he found himself living in a car with his 3-year-old son. To make ends meet, he even resorted to collecting discarded bottles to cash in at grocery stores. Then, he started selling shampoo door-to-door until he decided to start his own business in the hair products industry. So he teamed up with hairstylist Paul Mitchell, who died 9 years later, to create the hair care line. With his backers pulling out at the 11th hour, DeJoria had only $700 to invest in what could have been a risky venture, especially given that inflation, unemployment, and prime rates were at a high, and that the Paul Mitchell team was up against beauty giants like L'Oreal. But DeJoria kept walking into hair salons along Ventura Boulevard, facing one rejection after another, trying to land an order. It took 2 years until Paul Mitchell Systems was able to break even. DeJoria strongly believes that it is the obligation of all companies to do something of profit for their city, community, country, and planet. In 2008, he traveled to sub-Saharan Africa to join Nelson Mandela in his efforts to help feed over 17,000 orphaned children through Food for Africa. So one lesson aspiring entrepreneurs could learn from his life story is that debt is a viable option. It can be scary to take on, especially when your idea isn't a sure bet. But almost every successful businessman takes out a loan at some point to establish early momentum.
Number 27. What did DeJoria not do for a living before he started selling shampoo? Number 28. What is not true about Paul Mitchell? Number 29. Why did DeJoria undertake a risky venture when starting his business? Number 30. What could best characterize DeJoria? Number 31. What lesson can DeJoria's story give to young businessmen, according to the speaker? Number 32. What could be the title of today's show? Now you will hear the third talk. Look at the questions. Listen to an artist talking about her job.
Good evening. My name's Diane Simpson. I'm an artist and I'm here to talk about the difficulties of my job. What I faced right after my graduation was a serious existential crisis. As a fine art student, I always found the incentive and the inspiration to paint. But suddenly, I found myself into an am I even good enough to draw an eye frame of mind, which was a huge struggle. With my family's encouragement, I finally decided to take my artwork to the marketplace. I had to make a living somehow, and gradually my self-confidence was restored. But it is hard to make a decent living as an artist. Most of us work freelance, so we have to take samples or portfolios of our work from place to place, and we need to have a plan to attain more sales. And this was a grueling process. A friend suggested I experiment with illustration. Perhaps she could see the potential in me. I started drawing pictures for books, cards, and realized that putting my work in context, for some odd reason, made me more creative. So I took my illustrations collection around to prospective clients and employers. Of course, not having had any work published, it's tricky to convince publishers that your drawings will reproduce well in a book. So, this is how I overcame this problem. I attended a graphic design workshop which equipped me with the right programming skills to edit, and then print my work, adding some text next to it. So, a couple of publishers showed trust in me, and soon after my first books were sold, other clients followed. Overall, my advice to you is never to pigeonhole yourself, because this is what often happens in the art world. If you feel it happening to you, resist it. Otherwise, you'll never be able to branch off into other skill sets and increase your freelance potential.
Number 33. What problem did Diane face at the start of her career? Number 34. What is a basic worry budding artists are beset by? Number 35. What made Diane decide to become an illustrator? Number 36. How did publishers view Diane's work? Number 37. How did Diane manage to market her work to publishers? Number 38. What is Diane's advice to the audience? End of part 2.